Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Clinical Problem Solvers. Tonight, we have a very special guest who I am honored to introduce. Dr. Amit Goyal is currently a cardiology fellow at the Cleveland Clinic. He was most recently the assistant chief of service at the Johns Hopkins Hospital for the Barker firm. During my third year, he was my chief resident, and he's taught me so much of what I know and how I practice today. Amit, thank you so much for joining us.
Woo! Welcome, Amit. Hey, everyone. Such an honor to join you legends today. And RC, the teaching last year went both ways, my friend.
We are so excited to share your schema, Amit, for heart failure with newly reduced ejection fraction. To our incredible audience, if you're not driving, it might be helpful to pull up the schema on our app or on our website.
Wait. Let me interject. Oh my God.
He's going to kill me.
That was not normal.
Team, I have sad news. Reza is not here with us, which is why I'm doing the interjecting, which is why it just doesn't feel right. But I want to let you know that our fearless leader is modeling a terrific work-life balance. It's super late now, and he has a lot of work this tomorrow morning. He's actually on service. So as a team leader, he's modeling to us all that, hey, you know, our patients and our team come first, so he's not with us here today. But if he were, he would tell you to please consider buying the app. It really gives us crucial support in our mission to keep going. So on Reza's behalf, please buy the app.
Reza, we appreciate you.
All right, guys. So I have a great case tonight for you. We have Miss H, who is a 68-year-old woman who presented with a one-month history of progressive shortness of breath, orthopnea, and lower extremity edema. She had not seen a physician in 3 years, but reports being in her usual state of health until 1 month prior to admission. Prior to 1 month ago, she was able to walk a couple blocks before getting short of breath, but she now reports getting short of breath just walking to her bathroom, which is about 15 feet. She reports intermittent paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea and orthopnea requiring 3 pillows to sleep at night. On review of systems, she reports occasional productive cough with clear sputum. She believes she's gained weight and reports some abdominal distension, but has not weighed herself on a scale. She denies any fevers, chills, or chest pain.
Yet another opportunity to climb that dyspnea pyramid. You know, in reality, we're probably going to not be doing so much climbing and staying rooted in the base of that pyramid, and that is pulmonary and cardiac disease. If we do move that past that foundation, though, we usually encounter anemia or metabolic acidosis or a panic disorder. For a visual refresher, check out the schema on the website or the app, or actually listen to episode 18 where we feature that schema. So, as soon as you heard the word dyspnea, think of the pyramid and let the base rate of the disease, it will tell you to stay anchored towards the cardiopulmonary base. Now, most patients need a reasonable workup, the labs, EKG, imaging, and maybe even more. But one question that comes up often is how much progress you can make in the HPI alone. And this is a personal opinion. I think you can be confidently suspicious of 2 things. 1, inflammation, and 2, heart failure. Inflammation? Wow, you're probably wondering what a vague statement I just made. Well, if your patient, if your dyspneic patient has fevers and chills, you're probably dealing with an inflammatory cardiopulmonary disorder. And now that center of inflammation is usually the pulmonary parenchyma or the pleura, but it actually may be in the heart, in the pericardium, myocardium, or endocardium. So 1, inflammation. The other diagnosis you can be relatively confident of is heart failure. Our patient is a great example of how you can build a reasonable confidence around this diagnosis with the HPI alone. Here, the drop in exercise tolerance, shortness of breath, orthopnea, PND, edema, and possible weight gain make a pretty robust argument for what is, at the end of the day, a clinical diagnosis, congestive heart failure.
I love it, Ruby. That's exactly right. So heart failure at its core is a clinical diagnosis. It's a syndrome in which the heart is unable to meet the metabolic demands of the body or is able to do so only with elevated filling pressures. Ergo, patients present with signs and symptoms of congestion and or malperfusion. In one of the JAMA Rational Clinical Exam Series, they looked at the most predictive aspects of history, symptoms, and physical exam findings in diagnosing heart failure in ED patients presenting with dyspnea. Now, they present a lot of likelihood ratios, and I always had a hard time with those personally. So I'd like to remind you of a rule of thumb that always helped me. So for positive likelihood ratios, think about 2, 5, and 10, reflecting an increased probability of disease by 15, 30, and 45. And the converse is true for negative likelihood ratios, where you take the inverse of those numbers. 1 over 2, 1 over 5, and 1 over 10 decrease the probability by 15, 30, and 45% respectively. And to be honest, more important than the numbers and percentages, just think about a general gestalt for how much they change the probability. So 2, 5, and 10, modestly, moderately, and a lot of bit increase the likelihood of disease. With that in mind, they found that having a past medical history of heart failure or an MI moderately increased the likelihood of decompensated heart failure with positive likelihood ratios of 6 and 3 respectively. For symptoms of PND, arthropnea, and edema, which we think of as cardinal symptoms of heart failure, actually only modestly prioritize heart failure above other diagnoses with a positive likelihood ratio of about 2 each. On physical exam, JVD and abdominal jugular reflux are both moderately useful with positive likelihood ratios of 5 to 6, corresponding to about a 30 to 35% increase in probability. Now, the presence of an S3 is most specific with a whopping positive likelihood ratio of 11, increasing the probability by over 45%. But again, it's not very sensitive for ruling out heart failure. We all know that S3 is a classically described low-pitched extra heart sound best heard at the apex in the left lateral DQ position right after the S2 during early diastolic filling, changing the normal heart sounds from lub-dub, lub-dub, lub-dub to more of a Kentucky, Kentucky, Kentucky. Despite knowing all that, to be honest, I still have a hard time identifying an S3, and I imagine that's probably why the test is not sensitive. So if you do not hear an S3, that does not decrease the probability of heart failure by that much. Like many things, the bedside exam is, of course, an art, and deliberate practice is key to honing those skills. I'm still practicing.
Beautiful.
So a little bit more about our patient. Our past medical history and past surgical history were significant for hypertension, for which she was previously on HCTZ, breast cancer staged as T1, N1, M0, diagnosed in 2005, for which she underwent a resection, chemotherapy with doxorubicin, doxetaxel, and cyclophosphamide. She also has a history of peripheral vascular disease. Her social history and family history were unremarkable. On physical exam, she was afebrile. Blood pressure was 129 over 81. Heart rate was 94. Respiratory rate was 18. And she was sat 98% on room air. Generally, she was in no apparent distress, lying comfortably with the head of the bed elevated to 60 degrees, and her chest was cleared auscultation bilaterally with no wheezes or crackles. Cardiovascular, she had normal rate, regular rhythm, with no murmurs, rubs, or gallops, and her JVP was at the angle of the mandible with her sitting upright. Abdominal exam was unremarkable. Her extremities showed 3+ pinning edema up to the thighs bilaterally, and her skin was warm above the knees and tepid below the knees.
Like Amit mentioned, assessment of perfusion and congestion is key when you're evaluating a patient for heart failure. And it should be assessed as an aggregate of vital signs, history, physical exam, and blood work, since any one of parameter alone could be misleading. So let's tackle perfusion first. Assessment of perfusion will include a lower extremity being warm or cold. It's really important to feel above and below the knee, since a significant number of patients with heart failure may also have concomitant peripheral vascular disease, which may make the distal lower extremity cold to touch to begin with. You can also look at pulse pressure as a modest proxy for cardiac contractility. This is much more accurate with an A-line in place. You can look at urine output, blood work to look for ischemia, looking at lactic acid, elevated creatinine, elevated liver enzyme to get a better picture of what's going on.
Terrific. So to summarize, we really build the case for heart failure by looking for signs of less perfusion and more congestion. Now, the differential diagnosis for low perfusion is extensive. Think hypovolemia, obstructive shock, etc. So the findings of more congestion really add specificity to the working diagnosis of heart failure. And now, focusing in on our exam, there are three ways to assess for congestion. The first, seeing it with your very eyes. Second, feeling it. And yeah, you guessed it. Third is hearing it. So how can you see the congestion? Well, the jugular venous pressure. Of course, bilateral lower extremity as well, if it's particularly prominent. As a quick tangent, I will acknowledge that the JVP exam is super, super tough. The good news is there are two Twitter feeds of Dr. Zavin Sargassian and Andre Mansour that have some excellent tips that have really helped me with my exam. Okay, so that was seeing the congestion. How can you hear it? Well, crackles on the lung exam, and as Amit mentioned, an S3. And occasionally, your patient might have big pleural effusions from their heart failure, and that will result in reduced breath sounds. Feeling congestion, you say? Well, of course. Sometimes you may get really lucky and actually feel a pulsatile liver, which is very rare, but it may happen. And of course, if you percuss out ascites, assuming it's not from the liver and from the heart, that may be another way of feeling the congestion. Of course, yes, yes. The most common thing we feel is a lower extremity edema, but sometimes it's so overt that you actually just see it standing from the door. Okay, so that was the exam. Beyond that, a BNP and a chest x-ray can also be very helpful. They, of course, have very important pitfalls. The BNP. The BNP can be falsely normal in three situations. A large fraction of patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, in patients with an elevated BMI, and in cases where the atria and ventricles are compressed, not dilated, i.e. pericardial disease. A common cause of a false positive BNP, advanced renal disease. That's a really, really common cause. Believe it or not, patients in floored heart failure can have a completely normal chest x-ray. Two reasons that come up relatively frequently: isolated right heart failure, think your patients with primary pulmonary hypertension, and likely more commonly, hypertrophy of the pulmonary lymphatic circulation, which results in a super efficient clearance of the pulmonary edema. Those are the two explanations that I've come across. Now, if you have good POCUS ultrasound skills, this is a great place to use them, but we'll save that conversation for a later time. Okay, that was a lot. Why was that a lot? Well, the reality is congestive heart failure, like any clinical diagnosis, is rarely established with one singular finding, but it's rather putting all these disparate pieces that finally come together to form the puzzle.
That was awesome, Robbie. So let's apply that to our patient. Based on her exam, I would say the elevated JVP, the lower extremity edema, and her history of orthopnea and PND kind of points to her being congested or quote-unquote wet on the exam. I would very cautiously categorize her as being well perfused or sometimes referred to as warm based on the fact that above the knees, she felt warm to touch and she has a normal pulse pressure, but would really, really closely track urine output, get lactic acid and a complete metabolic panel to continue monitor her closely.
All right, guys, I may need to listen to that a couple more times to catch all those clinical pearls. But to summarize a few high points, we should assess patients with suspected heart failure for signs and symptoms of poor perfusion and congestion. Both of these should be assessed holistically using the history, physical exam, and further diagnostic testings. In examining perfusion, see if the patient has cool legs above and below the knees, monitor urine output, and evaluate for organ dysfunction in the blood work. In examining congestion, look at an elevated JVP, lower extremity edema, and pulmonary edema. Be sure to interpret a proBNP and clear lungs with nuance, though. All right, so a little bit more data. The CBC showed a white blood count of 4.3, hemoglobin 11.5, which is at her baseline, with an MCV of 77, and platelets of 210. Chemistries showed a sodium of 141, potassium of 4.4, chloride of 106, bicarb 24, BUN 21, creatinine 1.2, and LFTs were within normal limits. Lactic acid was 1.8, and a BNP was 1,021. Her EKG showed normal sinus rhythm. a first-degree AV block, a few PVCs, and poor R-wave progression. Her chest X-ray showed mild pulmonary vascular congestion, moderate right pleural effusion, and an enlarged cardiac silhouette. We got an echo, which showed an LVEF of 10 to 15% with global hypokinesis and biventricular dilatation, and no significant valvular disease and trace pericardial effusion. So, team, that was a ton of data. Can you help me interpret this, please?
At your service, my friend. Let's walk through it. Okay, so her hemoglobin is really not causing her symptoms, but the low MCV really needs some close attention. Odds are it's iron deficiency, which is not an uncommon finding in congestive heart failure. We don't have her baseline creatinine, but let's do the risk-averse thing and assume that she's got mild AKI. Now, I can promise you that Medicine Team 1 at the San Francisco VA can tell you the three most common causes of AKI in the context of heart failure. Yeah, we've had a lot of diuresing this week. So those three are congestive nephropathy, which we've had, hypovolemia from overdiuresis, which we've had, and acute tuberous necrosis from a prolonged hemodynamic insult, which we've also had. So to summarize, congestive nephropathy, hypovolemia from overdiuresis, and ATN. Given all the data here, really the data that says that she's volume overloaded, we're probably dealing with some mild congestive nephropathy. So onto the other lab. So her BNP coupled with the pulmonary congestion on chest X-ray again augment our hypothesis that she might have congestive heart failure. Before we jump to assuming the heart is big on X-ray, before the cardiac chambers are enlarged, you should always consider the possibility that the enlargement is actually pericardial in nature, i.e., a pericardial effusion. But here, her echo rules that possibility out.
Awesome. Yeah, and Robbie, I found the echo to be very revealing here. So first, it established severely reduced ejection fraction, which is a new diagnosis for our patient. But given the dilated chambers, I think we can be fairly certain that this isn't an acute process, that this has likely been going on for a long time. Dilation takes remodeling, which can only happen over time. Also, if this was an acute drop in our LV systolic function, I would expect her to be very ill, with frank pulmonary edema and possible shock. Overall, she appears well, and this also paints the picture of chronicity, and that although this is a new diagnosis for her, that the EF of 10 to 15% has likely been going on for a long time.
Alrighty, so to summarize the case so far, we have a 68-year-old woman with history of peripheral vascular disease, hypertension, and breast cancer diagnosed 11 years ago, and status post lumpectomy and chemotherapy with doxorubicin, doxytaxel, and cyclophosphamide, who presented with dyspnea, orthopnea, and lower extremity edema. Based on these symptoms and physical exam finding of volume overload, we diagnosed her with congestive heart failure. TTE showed nearly reduced ejection fraction as well. Arsalan, I thought we were friends. You gave me the sentence with all the medications. Alrighty, Amit. Here it is. What is your approach to heart failure with nearly reduced ejection fraction?
Charmaine, I thought you'd never ask. All right, so heart failure can be broken down into many different categories, but the biggest distinction at the get-go is whether it's heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFpEF, or is it heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or HFrEF. These follow distinct natural histories and, importantly, respond differently to therapies, and so the differentiation is quite important. And since our patient here has reduced EF, we'll focus on this bucket for this episode. So the first major branch point is whether she has ischemic or non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. And this is important because ischemic cardiomyopathy is by far and away the most common etiology of heart failure, accounting for up to two-thirds of HFrEF patients. Therefore, the first pass in evaluating newly diagnosed heart failure should be evaluating for coronary artery disease. Now, our patient does have risk factors for both ischemic as well as non-ischemic cardiomyopathies. She has peripheral vascular disease, which is a coronary artery disease equivalent, but she also has a history of breast cancer and was treated with doxorubicin, a notable cardiotoxic, as an anthracycline. Now, these anthracyclines are cardiotoxic in a dose-dependent manner, especially when a patient receives a lifetime cumulative dose of above 250 milligrams per meter squared by the surface area. However, toxicity can occur at any dose, and so this really will be an important consideration for her moving forward.
Amit, can you use the lack of regional wall motion abnormality and no history of chest pain to prioritize non-ischemic cardiomyopathy here?
That's a great question, Charmin. And yes, it will prioritize non-ischemic origin, but it certainly does not exclude an ischemic etiology, especially because severe triple vessel disease can give you a globally reduced EF, and not all patients with ischemic cardiomyopathy will have antecedent anginal symptoms, especially in diabetics and women who can present atypically. And these findings also are not specific, as up to a third of non-ischemic cardiomyopathy patients can have chest pain, and half of them can have regional wall motion abnormalities. Now, all patients with HFrEF, therefore, deserve some form of ischemic evaluation due to both the prevalence of ischemic cardiomyopathy and the opportunity to revascularize. If you're not testing for it, you're depriving them of this opportunity. The question remains, however, which study do you perform? There are so many to choose from. Coronary angiography remains the gold standard, but non-invasive imaging may be considered in some situations, okay? So for our patients, let's ask ourselves three questions, okay? So number one, are there anginal symptoms? Number two, is there a prior history of known CAD? And number three, are there risk factors for CAD? If the answers to any of these questions are yes, and the patient is a candidate for revascularization, then I would strongly advocate for coronary angiography. Indeed, the last 2016 ESC guidelines gave a class 1 indication for left heart cath in patients with heart failure and angina, and a class 2A indication for heart failure in patients with an intermediate to high pretest probability for coronary disease.
Terrific, Amit. And here's a situation where if the questions to Amit's three questions are no, then we consider non-invasive stress test imaging with a variety of options, including echocardiography, SPECT, PET, or cardiac MRI. These may be considered for intermediate pretest probability and have a grade 2B recommendation. The choice will really depend on local availability, preference, and expertise. Coronary CTA is an excellent tool for low intermediate probability or those with equivocal stress imaging.
All right, so our patient has peripheral arterial disease, which is a CAD equivalent, and additionally, she has risk factors of age and hypertension. If she had chest radiation for breast cancer, that would be an additional important risk factor for coronary disease that's often not thought of. As an aside, please remember that radiation heart disease can often manifest many years after treatment, and so a high index of suspicion is paramount. And the damage can involve every cardiac structure, coronary vessels, conduction system, valves, myocardium, and pericardium. Regardless, with this in mind, I would recommend a left heart cath for our patient, including any invasive coronary assessments like IFR, FFR, and intravascular ultrasound.
So, Amit, so many people have coronary artery disease without having reduced EF. If we get a left heart cath and it shows coronary artery disease, how can we be sure that it's driving the reduced EF?
There are two things to keep in mind while interpreting the left heart cath in this setting. Number one, if the degree of LV dysfunction is out of proportion to angiographic disease, she may still have a predominantly non-ischemic cardiomyopathy and the search for etiologies is still on. For example, if she has a obstructed non-dominant RCA with an EF of 10%, I think I would still prioritize the non-ischemic etiology. And number two, finding obstructive coronary disease does not necessarily imply causation unless there is also evidence of scar and or hibernation. Myocardial viability testing can help estimate the benefit a patient would derive from revascularization, which is especially useful in those with known CAD, but this is still a bit controversial.
Can I ask a question? What's hibernation?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's good. So hibernating myocardium is essentially a muscle tissue that's not getting enough blood, and so it just slows down its metabolic activity. And it goes from using fatty acids to glucose, and that's one of the reasons you can use FDG PET to see if it's viable.
Fascinating. I've never heard it being referred to that. That's awesome. Thanks, Amit. Teaching me so many things today. Yeah, awesome. So thank you so much for that. So I feel like ischemic cardiomyopathy has a clear pathway for workup, which boils down to assessing the coronary artery disease. To be honest, non-ischemic cardiomyopathy to me is a little less clear, and there are many different approaches. Now, Amit, do you mind sharing how you think through non-ischemic cardiomyopathy?
Yes, of course. This is a great topic because there are so many causes of non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. A good start is to think of four big buckets. Okay, by far and away, the largest bucket is idiopathic, which is just our way, of course, of saying who knows. But even in this population, up to a third can be familial in etiology. Let's call the second bucket abnormal loading conditions, in conditions that expose the LV to excess pressure or volume overload. primarily hypertension or valvular disease, both of which are responsible for a large portion of patients with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy as well. So number one, idiopathic. Number two, abnormal loading with hypertension and valvular disease. Number three is an important category, arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy, and I'll point you to a recent 2019 JACC review. This can be broken down into a few different subtypes. The most well-known probably is tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy, in which there's LV dysfunction from any cause that increases the heart rate, which is going to be more pronounced with higher heart rates that's occurring more often. Number two would be PVC-induced cardiomyopathy, which is usually requires at least a 10% PVC burden to develop the cardiomyopathy. AFib cardiomyopathy is a notion that AFib alone, even when rate-controlled, can lead to HFrEF, but this remains controversial. And then pacer-induced cardiomyopathy is LV dysfunction from RV pacing causing dyssynchrony. So number one, idiopathic. Number two, abnormal loading. And number three is arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy. Arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy, again, is a must-not-miss just because classically it's a reversible etiology and often goes underdiagnosed because it's just not thought of as often. Now, number fourth is the biggest bucket and consolidates a lot of the possible processes that directly affect the myocardium. Okay, you guys ready for this?
Woo! Always!
Toxic, inflammatory, metabolic, infiltrative, genetic, and stress-related.
Interjection. Okay, another one.
Whoa.
Oh my gosh.
What?
You know, I actually get a little bit of like palpitations and anxiety when I say that word now. He's like completely owned this word. Rez, please don't be angry at me. We miss you. Okay. Timmy G's. What am I talking about? Well, when Amit listed all those categories in the fourth bucket, toxic, inflammatory, metabolic, infiltrative, genetic, and stress-induced, well, that's a mouthful, but it naturally made me think of the very memorable mnemonic, T-I-M-I-G-S, Timmy G's.
Robbie, love the mnemonic. Now I can remember all of these as well. I'm writing it down. So here we go, folks. So T for Timmy G's is toxic cardiomyopathy, which can be from recreational drug use like alcohol and cocaine, radiation therapy, which may be relevant for our patients like with cancer, or medications, most prominently chemotherapy like anthracyclines, trastuzumab, and 5-FU. T for toxic. I is for inflammatory, which may be either infectious, think viral myocarditis, parasitic myocarditis, etc., or non-infectious, like giant cell myocarditis, which can be quite fulminant, and those related to connective tissue disease, just for some examples. So T for toxic, I for inflammatory. M is metabolic etiologies, which can be thought of either as hormonal, thyroid, and fewer are the ones that we probably think of at first glance, but my co-fellow Peter Hugh just told me about a patient he took care of. The patient had HFrEF because of a pituitary adenoma secreting growth hormone, a patient with acromegaly. So metabolic is hormonal and also nutritional deficiencies, like with thiamine and selenium. I is for infiltrative cardiomyopathy, and these are all the OCs, right? Like the amyloidosis, sarcoidosis, hemochromatosis. So we have toxic, inflammatory, metabolic, infiltrative. G is genetic cardiomyopathies. So think the familial dilated cardiomyopathies, LV non-compaction, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where 5 to 10% can have a reduced EF, and cardiomyopathy related to muscular dystrophies, just for some examples. The last one is sort of a grab bag, S for acute stressors. Now, stress-induced cardiomyopathy is a specific type of cardiomyopathy, also known as Takotsubo or broken heart, classically presenting as indistinguishable from acute coronary syndrome, and really as a pearl requires a left heart cath because it's a rule-out diagnosis, because it can present very similar to an LAD infarct. Other cardiomyopathies that can develop with acute stress include sepsis cardiomyopathy and peripartum cardiomyopathy.
Wow, that was awesome. And it's a big differential. So practically speaking, the workup of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction would have already started with the echo that showed a reduced ejection fraction. The same echo will also provide a lot of great information, including not only systolic and diastolic function, but also chamber size, valvular pathology, characteristics of infiltrative diseases, and more. EKGs are also easy to get and can be quite valuable in providing clues in terms of like whether there's arrhythmias present, are there Q waves to indicate prior infarction, low voltage and possible conduction abnormality to indicate that maybe an infiltrative process. So very quickly, we have information that can help build a case for an ischemic etiology or one of many diseases which fall under the non-ischemic cardiomyopathy bucket. The non-ischemic cardiomyopathy surge begins with a comprehensive history, and I mean all the histories of personal, family, medication, social history, including exposure to cardiotoxins. When clinically relevant, additional testing for HIV, thyroid disease, connective tissue disease, and other diseases such as like hemochromatosis, amyloidosis, or pheochromocytoma may be indicated. Arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy is a known misdiagnosis, so if the etiology remains unclear, ambulatory cardiac monitoring can be very informative. A genetics referral may be sought if the family history suggests of a genetic cardiomyopathy as well.
Wow, guys, that was an excellent rundown of where to begin. Fairly comprehensive. But if the diagnosis still remains unclear, consider a cardiac MRI. It really is a phenomenal for measuring volumes, cardiac mass, and EF of both ventricles, as well as differentiating ischemic from non-ischemic origins, determining viability, quantifying iron content, assessing valvular structure and function, as well as visualizing myocardial inflammation and fibrosis. It has an excellent study for otherwise undifferentiated non-ischemic cardiomyopathy for evaluating infiltrative, inflammatory, non-compaction, arrhythmogenic RV cardiomyopathy, and much more.
Wow, this is awesome. Okay, I'll chop that out. But it was the natural reaction.
Don't chop it out.
All right, guys. So Miss H was diuresed to clinical euvolemia. She was started on a beta blocker and an ARB, and she underwent a left and right heart catheterization. Left heart catheterization was notable for a mid-RCA subtotal occlusion with distal left-to-right collateralization, and the right heart cath showed a normal left and right chamber filling pressures and a normal cardiac output after diuresis and afterload reduction. Given her history in coronary angiography results, she was diagnosed with anthracycline-induced cardiomyopathy. Team, thank you for this awesome discussion. And folks out there listening, please be on the lookout for a CP Solvers blog where we'll feature clinical pearls for inpatient acute decompensated heart failure management and tips on introducing and uptitrating neurohormonal blockade.
I can't wait for that. That sounds awesome.
That sounds amazing. Hey, Amit, do you want to take the teaser?
Yeah, sure. How does a patient with a hip replacement manifest with heart failure many years down the road? So as always, feel free to answer the question through Twitter and stay tuned for the answer next week.
Amit, this is for you, my friend. This is for you. This is teaser part two. Name the two other prominent parts of this syndrome that Amit alluded to. Okay, so there's a hip replacement leading to heart failure. What happened? And then there are two other prominent features of this diagnosis that will clue you in. Okay, for super bonus points, which are, I don't know, worth nothing really, but for fun.
Awesome. Folks, make sure to check out our schemas on our website, clinicalproblemsolving.com. There you can subscribe to our weekly email summarizing the schemas and other pearls. Email us your feedback. We would love to hear from you at theclinicalproblemsolvers@gmail.com. And check out us on Twitter @CPSolvers. And here's a special announcement from the incredible Will Garneau.
Welcome to our friends and listeners all across the world. My name is Will Garneau, and I'm a general internist and one of the newest members of the CP Solvers team. I have two announcements. The first is that the Clinical Problem Solvers now has an Instagram account, @CPSolvers. To help celebrate, we wanted to start posting photos of the CP Solvers community. We are calling this Selfie Solvers. Basically, take a selfie with your favorite schema and post it on Instagram. Tag us, @CPSolvers, with the #SelfieSolvers so we can feature you on our page. The second announcement is that we are starting a Patreon page. Patreon is a way for listeners to support the CP Solvers and this podcast. Our plan is to always keep our content freely available. That means that the podcast, schemas, illness scripts will always be free and online at clinicalproblemsolving.com. We wanted to set up a way for listeners to help support what we're doing as we take the podcast to new heights. To check out the page, go to www.patreon.com/CPSolvers. For supporters of the Patreon, we are happy to provide the Clinical Problem Solvers app and also offer fun things in the future, like t-shirts. So, thanks for listening, and check out our Instagram and support us on Patreon.
Wait, hold on, guys. Before we end, I just want to say something. You know, it was such a joy to join you guys today. And I honestly, I'm reminded of 2 weeks I spent as a resident working with Reza. At the time, just in that short amount of time, his enthusiasm for diagnostic medicine was so inspiring and really downright infectious. It reminded me of why I went to med school in the first place. And team, now you're sharing that fire with the whole world. So on behalf of all your fans at home, in the car, at the gym, I just want to thank you for what you've done, what you're doing, and raise a toast to the clinical problem solvers, baby.
Woo!
Yeah.
Thank you, Ahmed. You're awesome. Woo!
That's very kind.
I love you guys.
That's a wrap, folks.
I feel like it is customary for our guest. Is that the right word? Customary? I don't know. It is tradition.
Hemochromatosis, amyloidosis, amphiochromatosis. Arsalan, what are you doing to me?